With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I get to catch up with Rael Reynolds of Enter Shikari ahead of the release of his book. It was good to catch up with Rael. I've not spoken to him for a while. He was a great guest on the Hardcore Listing podcast I do, also on the Distraction Pieces Network. And yeah, we had a good old natter this one, and obviously, Rael's got impeccable taste in tunes, so we spoke about some great records and a lot more. And before I get on with that chat, just a few thank yous. So I mentioned them a moment ago, but thanks to Scroobius Pip and everyone over on the Distraction Pieces Network. Also, thank you to 76 for producing this podcast. Thanks for Ian who helped facilitate this with Rael. And thanks to you lot for... You know, so many of these podcasts start with how people have coped throughout lockdown and, you know, how they've tried to maintain, you know, a healthy level of mental, you know, well-being. And this podcast, you know, I've said it before, but this podcast has been, you know, a real essential for me. You know, just being able to, you know, obviously you've seen it go from one a week to sometimes four or five episodes a week, which is... You know, I run a venue that's been closed, so this podcast has given me an opportunity to just reach out to other people that are, I guess, unable to do what they do. You know, musicians and comedians and actors and such, and it's just been really nice to connect with people, be it over Zoom, but just hear about their passion for records and to hear about their creative journey. It's been such an important thing for me this last year, and the fact that it's gathered listeners on that journey has been an absolute bonus. So, you know, being one of those, I'd like to thank you. So thank you very much for supporting this podcast. Okay, what else have I got to do now? I've sort of lost my way there. Well, I've done all the thank yous. So if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track podcast, then when you get to the end of this Ace Natter with Rael, then go and have a look in the archives, because there's 370 odd episodes now, and you can hear me talking to artists as diverse as Fatboy Slim, Butch Vig, the Foo Fighters, Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, Suede, comedians like James Acaster, Ed Gamble, Maisie Adam. You can hear me talking to actors such as Joe Hartley, Maxine Peake, Amanda Abington. Oh, there's loads. Go and have a little rummage around. Chuck D from Public Enemy, that's a great listen. Go and have a look, because there's hundreds now, and they're all free. So just find one and press play. Better still, you can subscribe. If you subscribe to the podcast, then you won't miss any. They just pop up on your listening device, and you just press play, and you're off. And if you'd like to support it in another way, aside from the likes, loves, shares, retweets and such on the socials, then what you can do is you can head over to Patreon, Patreon, patreon.com/offthebeatandtrack. And then over there, I put up radio shows, video episodes and all sorts of exclusive episodes and bits and pieces over there. And so, yeah, you can go and support the podcast over there from as little as, I think it's 79p a week, something like that. No, 79p a month. What am I saying? 79p a month. So, yeah, if you'd like to support us over there, that's much appreciated. If not, no drama. It's tough times. So, yeah, just do the free stuff. Give us a little subscribe or a share on the socials. Or just tell your mates. Just go, hey, this new podcast. It's all right. There's this fella from Essex with a bit of a lisp that talks to really interesting people. All right, that's enough waffle from me. Let's get some grade A chit-chat now from today's guest. So it gives me great pleasure to catch up and have this wonderful natter with Raoul Reynolds of Enter Shikari. Right, I've got to take a quick break in this podcast because I've got some super exciting news. Off the Beaten Track podcast is proud to go into partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. That's right. The Cacao Bar is not a chocolate bar. It's all the best bits of a chocolate bar put into a really exciting new alcoholic range. That's right. Gin, vodka, and a beautiful range of cream liqueurs. So one of the big bonuses of this partnership is obviously I'm super thrilled to have Hotel Chocolat working with us, but they sent me a great big box of this stuff. And I'm telling you, it's amazing. Go and check it out, www.hotelchocolat.com or over on the socials at Hotel Chocolat. But yeah, in the coming months, there's going to be opportunities for you to get involved with competitions with us, to win bottles of stuff. There's loads of exciting things coming soon, and I can't be more happy to say that this podcast is in partnership with the Cacao Bar from Hotel Chocolat. All right, let's get back to the podcast. It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin. Okay, we are recording. Joining me today via the means of Zoom, Raoul Reynolds. Hello.
Hello, sir.
How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, as I was just saying, I've just finished writing my book, which I am absolutely ecstatic about. To get that off my desk because it's it was a big project, and can sort of concentrate on music again because I haven't written any music since the end of the last album sessions, so a very long time ago. I'm looking forward to sort of relative freedom.
So in regards to the book, I mean, let's talk about that, you know, straight away, because was that something throughout lockdown? I've spoke to so many musicians that a lot of them have kind of bucked the idea of writing the lockdown album and have just actually quite enjoyed a bit of a system restore of not being touring and being able to spend time with family, and there's also been that other sort of, you know, percentage that have gone, at first it felt quite awkward, like I was pushing it to try and create something, and then as maybe those knee-jerk initial thoughts when we went into this situation that we're in eased a little bit and it become more of a normal situation, in a weird situation, that they started writing again. So was songwriting something at this point that just wasn't on your agenda, and did the book come from lockdown, or was that something that was already underway pre this situation that we're in?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm glad to hear that you've spoken to people who haven't used lockdown to write an album, because like all I was seeing last year was like people in the studio, our productive nature has gone through the roof, and I had nothing to give. It got like, I know towards the end of last year when I was sort of like taking breaks from the book and stuff and waiting for the publisher to get through with, get back with edits and things, I was like, right, I'll try and write some stuff now. And I felt completely lost. I mean, there's always a degree of anxiety before you sit down and write any new album, you know, because it's such a mammoth project. You just like, you know, you sit at the bottom of it and you're just like, Christ, how am I going to write another album? Like, this is such a colossal beast. But this was different. This was like, I think there was part of me that thought, you know, we've been a band for quite a long time now, and we've been very sort of overtly socially conscious and writing social criticism, you know, various systems and values and things. And a lot of the things that we've been writing about were becoming really, really just obvious, just like so vividly clear throughout all of last year. And, you know, the pandemic brought to light so many things that, you know, for one example, about our healthcare systems. And so I was like, I don't know what to write about now, because like this just makes me feel sick, because these are things we've spoken about for a while. So yeah, I've had nothing to give. I've not known what direction to go in. I've felt a little lost, and I haven't written anything, as I say. So you know, I'm sure it will come, so it doesn't bother me too much. But yeah, I put all my creative juices and passion into writing the book. I suppose I felt like, well, now is the time to actually delve into detail, because like this, things are getting so serious now, and people so often don't see the broader, like, systemic faults, you know, the root causes of things, that I feel like I need to write something a bit bigger, you know, something more detailed you can get across within the 4 minutes of a pop song.
Sure.
So the book was already underway before the first lockdown. But I suppose it did blossom quite substantially over the year, but I'm not sure. Some of that was probably due to the pandemic and due to me having more time off tour than I've ever had. And I was able to therefore explore more topics and write about a whole swathe of subjects. But I think also out of necessity, because, you know, once you go into one topic and you realize, oh, actually that connects to that, and I'm going to have to therefore explain that phenomena, and it just gets bigger and bigger. And, yeah, it turned out to be a big beast of nonfiction by the end of it.
And did the sort of nature of the writing become affected by the situation that, you know, that you and the rest of, you know, the planet was going through?
Yeah, I mean, I tried not to, you know, it's quite easy, especially when we go back to sort of March, April, and especially if people, you know, people listening to this, if they were in a position where they had people affected by COVID, and you know, God forbid, no one has been through having to deal with deaths, but you know, there was a period where it was like there was this new sense of the serious danger that we're in, and this, and the trajectories that we're on as a species, you know, not wanting to dive in too deeply and get too broad on this, but when we're going through periods like that, there's two things that happen. We can either slip into sort of fanaticism, and you know, there's a track on our last album, Apocaholics Anonymous, which is, you know, where we all just slip into apocaholicism, not the easiest word to say, but where we, you know, we can just become full of fear and fanaticism. Or we go the other way and we try and say, well, we're sharing this experience at the moment. This in some way, it proves our shared vulnerability. It proves our innate sort of unity as a species. You know, what, you know, one planet, one family, the things that us and, you know, many other people have spoken about for years. So there's a real degree of emotion that I think you have to be careful about when you're writing in those periods of, like, of turmoil.
Sure.
Because, you know, effectively I'm trying to write a book that covers social psychology, anthropology, systems theory, you know, quite sort of, I'm having to do a lot of research because I'm not sort of naturally very academical, really. So yeah, it was difficult, but I didn't want it to be sort of overly emotional. I wanted to show the readers what my emotions are upon, like, you know, looking at this data, but at the same time I wanted the book to be like to be centered in science and to be centered in reality, because it's as the album title of our last album, Nothing Is True, was the first half of the album title. It's so hard to ascertain what's true, what we can trust. Sure. In this day and age, so I wanted it to be really, you know, have a real core of science at its heart. So therefore you have to sort of keep your emotions in check and keep your opinions really in check. And you have to go, okay, I have to look at the data here and work out what I can write about.
Well, let's pick back up on the book and where people can find it and some more about it towards the end of the chat. But let's kick off the playlist, Raoul, and I'm going to ask you for track one, please, to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
This was a tough one, man.
This is what all the musicians say, that this is the tough one, man.
we actually had this conversation as a band. Like, Rob, our drummer, brought the intro conversation, as we've actually called it. It was a few months ago. And he said, because we were talking, you know, I was talking to the guys about how I'm struggling, as the songwriter of the band, I'm struggling here. Like, what can we do? And we'd, you know, the conversation blossomed off in all sorts of directions. We started, Rob brought up, like, you know what, we haven't written a song that has like a sort of seminal, immediately recognizable, short, succinct intro. You know, if you look back into sort of like, I think funk is probably the best area for intros. You know, have these like, you know, it can be a drum fill, it can be sort of a flurry of stabs on a brass, and you can hear, you know, the typical examples of like panel shows where people play the first second of a song and you have to guess what it is.
Yeah.
You want one of those intros, you know, you want one of your singles to have one of those just like immediately recognizable, like, ah, that's it, you know, onto the dance floor in intros. So yeah, we've been talking about intros a lot, and I sort of managed to narrow it down to three. I mean, it was hard to even get it to three, but I had it.
You are allowed honorable mentions, Raoul. It's okay.
Well, I thought Disco Inferno, the Halloween dancer, as a sort of a slightly cheeky one, silly one. Then I thought Paperback Writer by the Beatles, but I thought surely someone's had that by now.
No, like, one. Why has no really? One had that? We've had Beatles. We've had lots of people. A lot of people went for Help.
Just purely.
Just like Boom or Hard Day's Night. One called. Everyone knows it.
The classic. Yeah.
Paperback Writer. It's just that little bass line, that wee before, and there's a sense of urgency with that record, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, and the harmonies. Yeah. I think it's a three way, possibly even a four way, but it's you know, it's beautiful, and you don't really hear. God, I'm just going to sound old now, but you don't really hear like intros like that, do you? Just people singing, and it's just super engaging. You know, you hear it straight away. The way the sort of what would the word be? The contour of the melody is beautiful. Yeah. Paperback writer.
Yeah.
Excuse my early morning voice. Well, it's not even morning anymore. I've got nothing to stand by there.
No excuses there, Ralph. No,
but yeah, I love that. So I thought, well, it's probably either between paperback writer and then possibly an outside one, but Friday I'm in Love, The Cure.
Okay.
Because it's just those, it's like seven or eight notes or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just like a little arpeggio or a little scale. And it's just so beautiful. It's like this very open chord. And it creates, you know, as a songwriter, I think a lot of the times what you're trying to do with an intro is you're trying to create the universe the song will sit in. You want people to be immediately feel immersed in this world that you're creating. And to do that within like 2 seconds is difficult. Yeah. And it doesn't feel rushed. You know, it feels just like, it's almost like you're just sliding into this song really nicely. So yeah, I really, really like that. And I think as well, just that guitar sound, you know, the guitar sound of that whole era, really, the whole post-punk, you know, Joy Division, Bauhaus, XTC, like that's been a massive influence on us. And so that song has been sort of with us from as a band, as an inspiration for a long time.
And yeah, I mean, that Friday I'm in Love is pretty much a perfect pop record as well, you know, as it unfolds, it's faultless, that as a single. And so that's going to kind of lead me on really to a question that I like to ask songwriters. And that is, so if we look at like when Shikari first came out, the way that people were listening to music then was very different to how they're listening to music now. Not trying to make you feel old, mate.
No.
but obviously we've seen the evolution of all of these streaming services now that everybody is now using. And so I just wonder, the way that that's affected the way that a lot of younger people get their music, and they're now on things like TikTok and things like that. And I watch my daughter's thumbs, which seem to just be getting quicker and quicker and quicker. And I just wonder if the way that pop songs are being written there, you're hearing so many now that are just literally being pushed almost back to, I guess, that kind of Motown era of like 2.5 minutes, start with a chorus, no fat on it whatsoever, because attention spans for lots of younger people seem to be shorter. And that might be a wild generalization, but it does feel that we're in quite a fast-paced world of consumption for your media. And so, long way around this question, Raoul, like, the way that people listen to music now and the way that attention spans seem to be in certain areas shorter, does that have any effect on how you sit and write a record? You mentioned then that, you know, you said that we've never had a, you know, an instant intro, which is a rush to the dance floor. So is that something that, you know, that you are considering, and is that something that fast-paced want of like, just give me all the best bits straight away, does that ever kind of, do you know where I'm going with this question? Honestly, Raoul, I've asked this question about 250 times and I've never nailed it. I just can't seem to get out where I'm going with it, but I hope you understand where I'm leading you with this question. And,
absolutely.
And does it affect you?
Yeah, I think in a way, always the era that a piece of music is written in always influences the piece of music. You know, we could go all the way back to like one of my heroes, Stravinsky, back in like the 1920s when he released Serenade in A, I think it is. It's split up into four movements. Each movement is 3 minutes long. And they did that, or he wrote that, because that then fits on a 78 RPM record.
Right.
And so, like, I think the technology actually really inspires songwriters, be that consciously or subconsciously. I think it always has. And now we're seeing, as you've said, like a really powerful era of where technology is shortening attention spans. You know, you see it, you can look at like YouTube data and things like that of who actually gets to the end of a YouTube video. It's like pretty depressing. And I suppose,
but it's weird that it's gone that way though, Rob, because if you look at like people that were releasing records on vinyl in the 60s, 70s and 80s, you had X amount of space on that vinyl. So you could only get X amount of songs on there. And then with the CD, it allowed it to expand a little bit and you could have like longer albums. And yet now we've got this infinity, you know, of the Spotify's and the Apple Music. It's gone the other way. It's kind of gone. So go on. Sorry, I interrupted you there. Just thinking about the CD switching up from the vinyl.
Yeah, I suppose when the playing field is so infinite, it then becomes so what'd the word be?
Well, like saturated.
So saturated, so congested that there's just so much going on that then people only want the protein, because, you know, people's time is precious and increasingly precious as life gets more difficult. So they just want the immediate hit. They want to be immediately emotionally affected. They want to be immediately pleased. And we see that in, you know, in so many different industries. You know, to sort of take one step out further, and you think of Amazon, you think of being able to get something, you know, literally you can buy any product and have it on your doorstep within 24 hours. I mean, that's mad, like absolutely mad. So like, the whole playing field's changing. And I think it's definitely something we've thought about. Like, it's a weird one for us because with our music, it doesn't really fit in anywhere. In some terms, we're sort of a prog rock band, and we have this massive palette of instrumentation and emotion and texture to pick from. So for us, the thought of a sort of what a 2 minute now pop song, not the 3 minute pop song, it's 2 minutes. That's so daunting, because you, for us, we've always sort of prided ourselves on being like, I'm having real musical agility and variety and diversity. And that's been like one of our central, tenants as Enter Shikari. And there's not really a lot you can do in 2 minutes. You can't really show off. Show off is the wrong word.
There we go. We just want to show off.
There's only so much you can reveal of yourself in 2 minutes, so to speak. But I think it makes songwriting harder in a way, because for a band as well that's trying to talk about quite serious or at least deep topics, you need a broad palette. You need a real spectrum of instrumentation, and it's very difficult then to pummel that into 2 minutes.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Listen up. I've only got another new sponsor. Egg Fried. It's this super cool clothing label. And if you're into sort of skating and street art and gigging and kind of like really cool art and throwing a little bit of Asian culture and the designer's kind of weird sense of humour in the mix, then you're pretty much there with the wonderful world that is eggfried.com. Now, they do these amazing punchy kind of graphic tees, hoodies and sweatshirts, beautiful art prints, as well as this, they have a denim range, all handmade in-house, all supporting the slow fashion movement. Not only that, they've given you a discount code, 10% off when you head over to eggfried.com. Just use the code EGGSALAD, EGGSALAD, save 10%. Go and get lost in the world of Egg Fried. Also, they've got a new kids range, and it's called Small Fried, and it's super cool, super cute. And again, it's all over there in this wonderful world. Go and get involved at eggfried.com. Track two, Raoul, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to take you back now, and I'd like you to tell me the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
I have to go, again, you know, to be honest, all of these questions were tough, but I have to go with something from the world of Motown and Northern Soul, because, you know, that was the first thing I can remember. I tell a lie, my nan getting me into big band jazz as like a 5-year-old or something, you know, like running around with a toy trumpet listening to Glenn Miller. but I really don't have much recollection of that. That's more home video footage that aids my memory there. As a serious emotional impact that I can still remember to some degree, it's Motown and Northern Soul. So my dad was a Northern Soul DJ, and he used to play out as a DJ all around sort of the home counties really, and up and into the Midlands. And so he, you know, I was blessed really to have this basement that I was about to say basement that I grew up in, basement of the house that I grew up in.
That's quite sinister.
it was just full of his records. You know, he had kegs and boxes full of vinyl. And so, you know, I remember just days just getting lost in it, just putting on records as like a, I think from a 10-year-old upwards, really. And just getting lost in that sound. And because, it, you know, he had all sorts of stuff there from the mainstream. But yeah, the bulk of his music was Northern Soul. And I just remember being completely carried away by that and just loving the positivity of it, just the melody. I mean, I think that's where my love for melody comes from, really, because there isn't really much more of a melodic music than Motown. It's beautiful. So yeah, I was going to go for Tainted Love by Gloria Jones.
Oh, solid choice.
It's just such a high energy track. And yeah, I can literally, I have a real memory of just like running and dancing and flailing around my basement as a kid listening to that.
Oh, what a wonderful record. So if I had to sort of ask you to pinpoint what that emotion was it like sort of joy?
Exactly that. I don't think you can sum up Motown better than just the word joy. You know, still to this day, it's music I probably turn back to more than any other.
Yeah.
Which usually surprises people with a band like Enchi Corea. But as I say, like, there's clearly a love of melody within our music. So even if it isn't a sort of very overt and clearly recognizable influence, I think it is there. And in terms of its soul, you know, it's very much there within our music. So yeah, it was just unfettered joy, I think. And also you feel that to a greater extent as a kid as well, don't you?
Definitely. Definitely. And what's weird is like so many of them iconic Motown songs, whether it be Tainted Love, Tears of a Clown, Tracks of My Tears, This Old Heart of Mine, Uptight, they're all heartbreaking records, though. They're like the actual sort of, you know, the context of the lyrics is just, it's heartbreak.
Yeah.
Yet the music is just overwhelmingly, and obviously the vocals on every single one of them records that was ever made is, you know, it's just glorious. And it's just got that kind of overriding. The joy powers over the lyrics for me, and it's
I think I guess it comes out of blues as well, doesn't it? You know, it's like it's experiencing serious hardship, be that romantic or you know otherwise, and being able to sort of compartmentalize it and process it and make something beautiful out of it.
Absolutely.
And it takes real skill, and I think it's something that not just within Motown, I think it's something within music and various genres that has really influenced us. You know, exactly the same thing happened in post-punk, and we attempt to do the same thing a lot as well, especially with our lot sort of happier tracks. You know, a lot of our previous album, The Spark, was you know the subject matter was pretty emotional. Full of adversity, but then a lot of the music was quite joyous and quite upbeat, and that's something that I think directly comes from Motown. It's something that they do better than anywhere else, and as well, I think with politics, you know, it was one of the first genres, you know, I know of that as well started to be quite overt in not just of its adversity in relationships, but in adversity in wider social relationships, you know, like Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, and the Temptations. When Tamla Motown made that shift to like suddenly going, oh, we can actually use our platform to speak about serious issues.
And I think that was the artist that weren't Berry Gordy. Like, I think that was Marvin Gaye's brother coming back from Vietnam and telling the stories.
Right.
And I think that was when, because I think it's quite well documented that Berry Gordy was like, what's this? And it's like, because it's a concept record, isn't it? You know, it flows from beginning to end. And I think it wasn't that sweet, you know, it wasn't Ain't No Mountain High Enough, I Heard It Through the Grapevine. It was really saying something. And you're right, it did. It then kind of, from that, all of a sudden you're hearing, you know, you're not hearing Reach Out, I'll Be There. You're hearing Papa Was a Rolling Stone. And it was like, whoa, what's this? This is like got a, you know, by the time that intro's started, most Motown songs had finished. Like, yeah. It's just this huge expanse of like sound. And yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree any more with you there, Raoul.
Oh, man, we should start a Motown podcast. There's loads of questions I'd love to ask you about.
And my knowledge of Northern Soul is something I'm always looking to grow. So yeah, I'll be picking your brains, mate. For track three, Stay in the Formative Years here, Raoul, I'm going to ask you to tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Again, difficult. I remember getting cassette tapes, compilation tapes made by my cousins. And they were, you know, a few years older than me, into Britpop, and they basically introduced me to that whole world. And the one that I think, you know, that, well, there's so many that stand out, but I was going to go for Aqueous by Oasis.
Mm.
And I remember, you know, I knew Oasis and I liked them as a, I don't know, what would have this been, like a 10, 11, 12-year-old or something. But I remember my cousins introduced me to their B-sides.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and again, as a kid that had grown up with vinyl and knowing about the B-side and almost this, the mystical, magical, you know, nature of the B-side, hearing Aqueous for the first time was just like, oh my God, this is like better than anything that I've heard by them ever. Like, so yeah, that, and that just takes me back to school and that whole period of my life for sure.
It's so weird. I think, you know, whatever your thoughts are on Oasis at that point, as a songwriter, he weren't struggling. If you look at, like, Some Might Say, which was the track that was the flip side of, I think I had the CD single of it as well, and that had Some Might Say, Aqueous, and Talk Tonight. And you listen to, like, and obviously, what were the other B-sides? Master Plan. You just think, that's like most Britpop bands that give their right arm to have a song like that. And he's tossing them off on B-sides. It's like, you've got an air of confidence. I mean, obviously, they've never seemed to lack confidence, them brothers. But there must have been an air of confidence there to just think, no, that's all right. Because surely if you wrote something like you think, the record company must have been screaming at you that's a single. And whether or not they just thought, oh, do you know what? We won't even bank it for another album. We'll just stick it on the B-side. I mean, it's just incredible. And so how did that whole kind of Britpop, I mean, was you getting exposed to all the other stuff in and around that scene, like further outside of like your Blur and Oasis? Was you getting, you know, mixtapes with your Blue Tones and Shed Sevens and all that on it?
Yeah, I think so, to a degree. I mean, certainly it was Blur and Oasis that made up the majority of the cassette tapes that I was given. And I suppose the more modern stuff as well, like, I mean, Stereophonics. I was going to pick a Manic Street Preachers track for one of the other questions, so maybe I won't speak about them now.
Okay.
There was all sorts. Even things like Crowded House as well, like going back a bit. What's that?
By Crowded Ass. Oh, Ocean Colour Scene.
Yeah, Ocean Colour Scene. I remember...
there's an intro.
I remember that was one of the first tracks that we used to play with Rob when we had just me, him and Chris were in a band for a while, and that was a jam of ours.
You still playing your plastic trumpet at that point, Ro?
Yeah, that was a few years after I'd come out of that phase.
Well, what I want to ask you now, Ro, is just a little bit about school. And, like, you know, did you enjoy it? And where was it?
Secondary school was, for me, I moved to Scotland when I was 10, I think. So I had like 3 years up there. So I had year seven in secondary school up in Scotland, and then moved back down. So I think that period was difficult because it was difficult moving to Scotland. You know, being the only, actually not the only English kid, but one of two English kids in a class, and the other English kid was a bit of an arsehole. So that was difficult. But then, moving back down, you know, by the time I'd spent 3 years there, I had a whole circle of friends. I had a band as a 13-year-old, and it was, I absolutely adored where we lived. We were up in the Trossachs, like in a little village called Callander, near Stirling. And I have such fond memories of there. So then having to leave that and then join another school, again, not knowing anyone, I think it's sort of, I was quite a loud child, I think, and it sort of beat some of that out of me, and I think sort of introduced me to social anxiety. So there are definitely difficulties there, and I think as a learner, I wasn't really great. I wasn't bad. I was just sort of like in the middle. I didn't try massively hard. I was, you know, clearly besotted by music by that point, so it was hard to sort of get me passionate about any other subject. I was just so into it. So a bit of a mixed bag, really, of schooling, some highs and lows, I suppose.
I mean, to change schools twice around that age as well, that's pretty tough, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I can barely remember it now. That's the thing. But I mean, certainly moving to Scotland was really difficult. I mean, it was difficult for my whole family, really. But we had to, because that's where my dad's job had taken him up there, and he was trying to, you know, do the thing where he'd live up there for the weekdays and come back at the weekends, and it just wasn't working. And we all made the move, and it was. I can remember. I mean, there's a stupid story that it's very blurry now, but I don't remember being physically bullied, but there was, you know, it was definitely difficult, like on a verbal basis. And I can remember the teacher on my first day sat me next to the English kid because she thought like that would make me feel more comfortable. And this guy was I remember it quite well, how much of a prick he was. You know, poor kid, he probably, you know, had some difficulties in his own family or whatever that was bringing out some horrible aspects of him. And it wasn't until me and this kid had a fight that then I was like accepted into like the clan.
You'd earned your stripes.
It was so they started, the kids at the school, so not all of these English kids are twats then, like. I was sort of accepted. So as I say, by like, you know, after the first 6 months, I think I was, absolutely loved the friends I'd gained. I'd loved the area. I loved that sort of lifestyle that we had, like being much more in nature, really. You know, I had, we were right near Ben Leddy and had all these amazing walks all around us and places to play and, you know, be a bit of a feral child. So I think that helped immensely. It certainly had its difficulties.
Well, you said that you was a lad child, and then obviously you just said some of that kind of verbal bullying and stuff can kind of definitely cause some social anxiety and things like that. But where I'm going with this is, I've seen your band at festivals and stuff, and I've seen an incredible front man on stage doing what he does, and it exudes confidence to somebody that's standing there watching that. You know, I've also met you previously, and you're a humble, nice, polite, you know, guy. And so I just wonder what your relationship has been with confidence from having them kind of tricky times then to sort of moving forwards to then having to sort of walk out onto stages at these huge gigs and festivals. I just wonder what your relationship is with confidence.
Yeah. I mean, it's always been something I've struggled with, especially since those moves as a kid. And I think you basically gain confidence in different areas of your life, you know, through repetition. So the reason I can exude confidence as a front man is because I've been doing that since I was 14, 15.
Yeah.
I was actually a guitarist first, but then sort of fell into the front man position. And, you know, it's like anything. I used to be scared of flying. And when tour forced me to have to fly all the time, eventually realized that, you know, the ways I feel, the anxiety that I feel and the panic I feel is just inside, and it's something that I can deal with, and I can you know, work on, and so that, I think that's it. It's just like, the more we can go into like cognitive behavioral therapy here, that, and it's sort of, it's like exposure therapy, isn't it? The more you expose yourself to something that you're afraid of, and realize that actually your worst fears are not going to come true. The less debilitating your anxiety and your lack of confidence becomes. And I think that's happened in lots of points in my life. But I mean, I still struggle immensely with social anxiety. Like, I find it much easier to stand on a stage in front of 100,000 people at a festival than I do sort of walking into a party or some event where I only know a few people, I've got to sort of suddenly meet a load of new people. I still find that very difficult. But yeah, you know, you live and you learn.
Absolutely. What was the first record you bought, Rao?
Well, yes. How far do you want to go back? I mean, there's the slightly embarrassing. No, it's not embarrassing. Spice Girls, the first album. I remember picking that up on cassette as a kid. That wasn't from a record store. That was from literally from a service station. I remember we were going on a family holiday, and my mum and dad gave me some money. I was like, "Right, you can buy one album that we can listen to, you know, throughout the holiday." That's like a 9-year-old or something. Went with that. But no, I think that this is where I was going to go with the Manics, because it was if we're talking song rather than album. I remember the masses against the masses against the classes, or the masses against the classes, coming out. And I think I was about 13, 14. And I remember getting that on single and just being absolutely in love with it. Like, I'd already, again, that was another band that, actually, I don't think it was my cousins. It was one of my my best friend's older brothers, who was a massive sort of, you know, indie kid. And he introduced me to the Manics. And so that was the first single I remember walking into a record shop and buying.
Was you aware of the sort of political angle of the band? You know, could you? Because I mean, they weren't shy in what they were saying on a lot of records. And was that something at that age that you was picking up on, or was it just pure melody and guitars and stuff?
I think I've talked about this with Rage Against the Machine. I think as a kid, there was you grasped sort of a sense of what was going on. You know, I have no idea about the intricacies of what they were talking about, the concepts. You know, that the track starts off with Noam Chomsky, doesn't it? And you know, I wouldn't have understand one sentence that he says at that age. But yeah, that there was like, I was immediately drawn to music as this sort of powerful, emboldening, unifying tool. And I experienced that when my local scene, like the first local bands I went to see at our youth club as a sort of 14, 15 year old, were like hardcore punk bands, ska bands, you know, sort of DIY small scenes that were popping up everywhere, and all those bands would be playing in the small towns and doing tours and stuff, and they, you know, they'd do the odd speech here and there, or, you know, you'd learn the lyrics and you realize, oh, this is interesting. Are they speaking about this, or what does this mean? And just, I think I fell in love with just, yeah, being able, like, if you're lucky enough to sort of build a fan base or like gain some sort of pedestal, then using that, you know, feeling the responsibility and like going, okay, what can I talk about? And not even just from a feeling the responsibility, but like, whether it's Manics and it's whatever you would want to call them, indie rock, punk rock, whatever, or whether it's, you know, hardcore punk, there's genres that rely on passion. Like, that is the central, you know, the whole thing of like punk was like, we're not really musicians, you know, we're certainly not virtuoso guitarists or anything. Like, we don't have great skill, but we have soul, we have like passion, we have beliefs and ideas, and
got something to say.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that was immediately just, I found that magnetizing, and you got that so much from the Manix, and as well from Rage Against the Machine. So no, I didn't have a clue about their politics, but I was like, I was still into it. I was like, yeah, I would die for this too, man. Like, I don't know what it is, but like, I feel it. Like,
but I think, you know, as a teenager, you know, most teenagers are, you know, have a time of being angry, and I think if you're being exposed to, you know, like you say, hardcore and bands like Rage and that, I mean, it just sits right. It's, you know, it just soundtracks that anger perfectly, and it almost gives you a, you know, an outlet. And you know, you surely must see that, you know, when you're on stage and you're seeing, you know, these kids in the crowd just feeling that, you know, having that outburst and using it, you know, music to kind of express themselves. Do you know what I mean? I've walked through my school and college with like my favorite band written on my like rucksack or whatever, just because I kind of wanted everyone to know that, yeah, I like Billy Bragg. Yeah, have you heard of him? Like, you know, it's like, but that's that time, isn't it? You've got something to say, and I think, and also half the time you've got no money, so that then does push through. Just go sort of full circle a little bit, that DIY thing that you was talking about in your first bands, where, you know, you're all kind of helping each other out because, you know, someone's got a drum kit, someone's dad's got a van that can help get that band to there. And it's like, and it's, for me, you know, I dabbled in music for quite a few years, but then when I sit with some of people I was in bands with now and we talk, we always go back to them first rehearsals in mates' garages and like, and that first gig. Can you remember who we played with there? And because it's all to be played for then, isn't it? And it's all just so new and exciting, and you are fired up, angry, and yeah. And so I'll tell you where I want to go with this question. I touched on confidence, and around the scene that you know, that Shikari were part of in those sort of formative years, lots of bands from that era have kind of gone on to be other bits and pieces, and not many of them have seen the level of commercial success that Enter Shikari has. So aside from confidence, would you say you're driven?
Oh, immensely. Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people sort of talk about how they couldn't live without something. And I think that's what's made this, you know, this last year of lockdown particularly different, particularly difficult for my mental health, is that I haven't had this creative outlet in terms of making music, you know, this cathartic, wonderful tool, this outlet that I've had since I've not even got a guitar. Yeah. Got my actual first real trumpet when I was like 8 or something, you know, like music has always been there. So it's and since then it's been my sort of prime drive, my primal drive, because it really does feel primal. It feels like I have to do this. Like I have to, this is how I communicate almost, you know. It's like, so that drive just comes very naturally. And I mean, going back to what you're talking about the whole DIY thing as well. And with like, being sort of slowly becoming aware of what these bands were talking about, we very quickly came up against like difficulties in our local scene. Like our local council was horrendous. I mean, you know, we come from St. Albans. It's a sort of, it ricochets back between conservative and liberal Democrat, Democrat, and how it's run. And of course, you know, when you get into like local councils, a lot of these people are sort of quite out of touch, especially with youth services and things like that. So we immediately had immense struggles with being able to put on shows. Like we were doing like the Duke of Edinburgh Award, God rest his soul, at the from what was that, like when you're 14, 15, I think you start doing that. And you know, one of the sort of parts of the scheme, which I think, you know, is a brilliant scheme, is you have to sort of start an organization or a business on some level. And we started our own local promotions company, and we put on gigs, you know, as 15-year-olds. And we immediately, you know, even though it was a school-led program, we came up against so many problems with our local council. So, yeah, I mean, I could talk about that for ages, but what I'm saying is we immediately found out that this, you know, whether it was a mistrust of authority or whether it was like a finding out about the systemic problems in the world, like so what Mannix had been talking about, what Rage had been talking about, what Motown had been talking about, it immediately became very clear, like, to us, like, on a local level, yes, but like, it was like, ah, okay, I get it now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess in and around that time, you hit an age where you can go clubbing, and I always like to sort of make this question a little bit more broader, because I think when people read it, sometimes it makes them think it's some kind of chrome laden club where, you know, you've had to wear a pair of trousers to get into it. It's not. It can be anything. It can be your local indie night. It can be your local rock club. It can be any kind of clubbing that.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
That you experience, but Ro, I'm going to ask you for a song that soundtracked your years in Clubland, please.
Yeah. Well, for me, I mean, if I could sort of, I don't have to pick two, but like maybe there's the first one that has to be said, and this won't come a surprise to anyone, would be the Prodigy, No Good, Start the Dance. Like, my uncle introduced me to the Prodigy as a kid. And blew my mind, you know, as a kid growing up with Britpop primarily and ye oldie music like Motown and some of the other tracks that we'll find out in the next answers. This was just like a complete new universe. But I can't say I was going clubbing as a young 10-year-old or whenever it was that my uncle gave me music for a generation.
What was it, just quickly before you move on, what was it that struck you about that? I mean, it's well documented, it's just fucking incredible, that's a given. But like, what was it that, I mean, was there a visual there for you as well?
Visually, it was mad, wasn't it? I mean, like, the Fatal Land cover, I remember seeing that on my uncle's collection and just being like, what? That's just a mental cover. And then seeing the Jilted Generation and him literally passing me that, I go, listen to this first.
Like, everything will be all right.
Yeah, he wanted me to like grow with him and like, you know, experience the albums that he experienced them in that order.
That's wonderful though, isn't it? That's great, absolutely. That someone was doing that. That's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. But you know, that cover's kind of terrifying. Mm. So for a kid to see that, I can't think of any way to describe it other than it was just a completely new universe, you know, visually, aesthetically, the sounds, you know, a breakbeat, you know, I hadn't heard anything like that. It was just like a real drum kit playing at simple beats with the odd fill. Yeah. That's all I'd heard. And then, you know, synth, that started my love affair with synthesis. So, I mean, that was everything. And even like with Shikari for like a few years around our first and second album, like No Good, Start the Dance was our like intro song, so we'd come on stage to that, which was ridiculous. And I think so that sort of gave me a grounding in electronic dance music, but it was drum and bass that was my first like real, you know, you can be impassioned and excited by being passed down something, but when you like discover it yourself and you sort of, you feel like you're growing with a genre and you feel like you have a, you know, I certainly wasn't there since day one of Jungle or for instance, but like,
sure,
in terms of like liquid drum and bass, like Hospital Records, who we've done a whole remix album with a few years ago, like they were like, discovering them was everything. So like we had it was called the Monday Club down at the Horn in St Albans, and that was like a drum and bass club effectively, and Rory, our guitarist, his brother was a drum and bass DJ,
Sam PDX.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So discovering that whole world was just like wow, it was amazing. So that was my first sort of clubbing experience, I think.
And I mean, just, you know, I thought it was really interesting as well that, you know, which I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, Raul here, but, you know, when Shikari broke through, there was lots of kind of rock and metal kids that were loving it. And to then have PDX open for you quite a lot as well, didn't he? Like, to expose these kids to drum and bass, I just think it was fucking incredible. What a great thing to do. Just, you know, use that opportunity to turn people onto something that potentially they might not be overly aware of. Like, was that something that was a conscious decision?
Yeah, for many reasons. I think one selfish reason is because, as a band, we all love it. And, you know, growing up with PDX and going to Rory and Sam's house and just that was always on, you know, that was like the background music. So for us, that's like drum and bass is like almost like a comfort.
Yeah.
In the same way that Motown is, it's just like, I feel very, very grounded, very at home there. So I think we wanted to help people feel that same atmosphere. So like, you know, between bands, we've always played drum and bass, and we still do. The funny thing is when we do that in America, and you know, it's almost not a thing out there. It's in some states that they're like, what is this? It's like EDM, man, but it's like really fast. It's super fast. So like, just yeah, being able to introduce people to that whole world, because it's such a varied world, you know, especially with as jungle grew and we had all these subgenres, and as I say, especially with liquid drum and bass, like it, you know, in some tracks it's like orchestral and majestic and beautiful, and in some, you know, the next minute it's just like the damn right dirtiest, just like immediately like jump up drum and bass, you know, making you want to get on the dance floor. Like, so there's such variety there, and we found it immensely inspiring as you know, myself as a songwriter and the band. That was it was always a genre that has probably taught me more in terms of production than any other.
Well, let's take you home, and for track six I'm going to ask you, Ralph, for a favorite song from an artist from your home county, please.
Oh,
you've done it as well, haven't you? You've done it as well. Don't worry, mate. You're probably number 230 of 270 that thought it said country. Don't worry.
Oh, my God, really?
I need to put that in block capitals because everyone does it, mate.
Because I thought it was like home country. That's kind of weird. I even thought it was like a weird question. Oh, shit. Right. Well, I'm going to have to rethink that.
Out of interest, what did you go for?
Well, home country, I was going to go for Under Pressure by Queen and Bowie.
Lovely.
But
not from St. Albans, though.
No, okay. Well, yeah, in that case, then it has to be someone from our local scene. Like our local scene was pivotal in forming Shikari's sound, just as much, if not more, as any other of the genres that we've discussed so far. So there were lots of like smaller bands, like Cry for Silence, Aconite Thrill, Incoherence. And I suppose the biggest band that made it out of that sort of Luton, Watford, St Albans, Harpenden, that world would be Sixth. And I think they're the only one that made like a real global presence, you know, that they sort of, you know, within the gent world, they're sort of considered like quite seminal, you know, pioneers. And I mean, for me, I remember seeing them at the Pioneer Youth Club, so the club that we used to try and put shows on as kids. And I remember, you know, this was a super rundown, shitty club. And there was no lighting. It was this crappy old PA. And they brought their own lighting with them. I say lighting. It was literally just two. Am I allowed to swear on this? two fuck off powerful strobe lights.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I think I knew what a strobe light was and stuff as a kid, but like they would switch the strobe lights on like full power, you know, going like that speed. And you know, at the start of the song it would come on, at the end of the song it would come off. And so if you know, if you had photosensitive epilepsy, you were fucked. Like it was
an intense experience, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean that's their music is intense. So I remember that was the first time I saw them, and just being partly terrified, partly just like flabbergasted by like the sheer skill. But then also there was beautiful moments of melody there when Justin would do like sing a nice chorus or a middle eight or something. Lyrically really interesting. And technically and rhythmically just incredible. It would have to be sixth. I'm like going to Spotify now, cause I wouldn't know which. There were so many good songs. Christ.
And was it inspiring to see someone from your scene, you know, do something and just think, you know, because did it feel attainable, you know, where, you know, in the area that you grew up in, that you could get signed, you could do this, you could go on and you know, and do the things that you have done?
I think we, at moments, there were moments where we thought that and we were very positive. And then there's a specific moment I'll talk about where that we felt that wasn't the case. But there's something about knowing that these people came literally from down the road from you.
Sure.
And when you look at them, when you're looking at them on stage, you're like, you know, you're just taken aback with the sheer skill and the power, you know, that they really exemplify the power of a band in terms of like, it's almost like the whole band is an instrument. The way that the drums are locked with these intensely technical guitar lines, and being able to pull that off and being tight live, like that, there's something incredible about that. So when you look at them on stage, you're just like, whoa, these are gods. And then they come off stage and you talk to them, you know, as used to happen at local gigs, you know, you'd be able to like chat to the band and you know, you'd know people, you'd share friends, you'd go to the same places, and it's just like, and that made it seem much more like accessible, you know, to be able to get onto a stage and be a band and have some sort of success. But even the first label that showed us interest was Sixth's label. Not they didn't own the label, but the label that Sixth were on. And that ended up being a quite a terrible deal that we were offered. So it was very lucky that we'd just taken on our manager at the time, and he sort of steered us away from that. So that was quite a shock that, okay, people are out to screw you over in this industry. Because, you know, we just that label coming to us and offering us a deal, we were just like, you know, sort of wide-eyed and bushy-tailed. Oh, my God, this is awesome. Like, that would have been terrible if we would have signed that deal. So at that point, we were like, okay, maybe it's not possible to walk in this band's footsteps. But yeah.
Well, for the last track, Raoul, you can play DJ now and Tastemaker. And I'm going to ask you for a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
Yeah, I feel bad, though. I didn't actually name a track, did I, for
Sick? Oh, you didn't? Sorry, go on.
I would either go for, I think the first track I heard was Pussyfoot, or possibly Hold My Finger. So I would go for either of those. But I mean, the Trees Are Dead and Dried Out, that album is incredible if anyone doesn't know them or wants to start somewhere. What was it? Yeah, the track that I want other people
many
to...
Many may not know. Yeah. Turn them on to something new, Raoul.
Yeah, I mean, I thought as we're recording this and the sun is out and we're sort of venturing into spring and summer, I'd pick something like really summery and positive. So I'm going to go with Rena Mashonga. She is an incredible artist, like super diverse, a really interesting voice. Like, she has this quite amazing backstory. She's like a proper, you know, like citizen of the world. So she was born in India. She grew up in Zimbabwe. Then I think she like moved to, oh yeah, she went to college in the Netherlands and then moved to Peckham. And so she's got all these influences and like experiences, and you can hear it in the music. It's like awesome. And it's not just that, also that the production is really clever. Like it manages to kind of sit in the middle of like that very, very raw and quite sparse production. So you can really pick out every aspect of the track, every bit of instrument. And the vocals are given a good amount of space to, like, you know, for the power of her sure. vocals to come through. But at the same time, it's like really technically proficient as well, the production. Like, you know, it could be like Forte or Caribou or something. It's like really interesting. And yeah, it's just listening to her stuff just like fills me with that, you know, that summer feeling, that just like good yeah. times are ahead, sort of, you know, drinking a tinny with your mates down the park or something. Like it just gets you excited. But yeah, I was going to go for a song called Atlanta, which is, I think it's off not the recent album, but the one before that. But yeah, all of her stuff's great.
Wonderful. Well, we put together a Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast with all your track selections on and some of the other records we spoke about, so people can go and explore all of those. So with that kind of summer feeling and the sun shining today and an air of optimism that 2021 is going to start to unfold, you know, further to a place where we can hug our friends and we can get back to so many of them moments of connection that we've been missing. What are you looking forward to personally, and what's happening professionally?
I still haven't gone to the pub.
I haven't.
Oh, I thought I was an outlier. No.
Let's go get a pint. Come on.
Yeah, so I'm very much looking forward to that first cold pint out of a glass in a pub garden. Yeah, just looking forward to, you know, seeing the people who I haven't seen for so long. You know, been lucky enough to see the band now and then. I mean, certainly not that much. You know, I like to think that our tour is going to go ahead in November, December. So I can't wait to see our crew again. Like, I haven't seen any of our road crew for, over a year, which is weird. You know, I've never experienced that. We've never gone more than sort of 3 months without playing a show throughout our existence from sort of 2006-07 onwards. So yeah, looking forward to seeing them again. Obviously, just looking forward to playing shows again, looking forward to being able to like meet like our supporters again. I think that's about it. There's just so many friends that I haven't seen, and as you say, just looking forward to human contact again. Yeah. Like, looking forward to getting my shot of oxytocin from hugging and feeling the sort of human connection that we've all been starved of for over a year now.
If people want to find out more about the book, where's the best place to do that, Raoul?
I guess just entershikari.com. We've got pre-orders up there now. And then, I mean, I'll be sort of starting to tease it over on my Twitter accounts. So that's just Raoul Reynolds, Raoul's R-O-U. And then obviously Entershikari, our Twitter account there. That's
wonderful.
About it.
Raoul, it's been an absolute pleasure talking records with you today. Thanks so much for your time, mate.
Man, no, thank you for having me. Like, it's always great to talk to you, and great to talk about these tracks that have made up such a big part of my life.
Wonderful. Thanks loads, Raoul.
Wicked, man. Take care.
Do you know what? I knew that chat was going to be great, and it really was. I hope you've got as much joy listening to that as I did having that chat with Raoul. Go check out the book. Go pre-order it. And yeah, go and head over to Spotify and listen to all of Raoul's song choices as well. And why not listen to his favourite song from his home country as well? Go and listen to Under Pressure by Queen and Bowie. I do need to sort that out, because it's just one of them things that is a constant, and it's all my fault. So I'm going to sort that out now. All right, I'll be back next time. As mentioned at the beginning, if you can give us a like, love, share, retweet, and all of that stuff. Subscribe's really good. If you want to leave a review, that's lovely. Drop us a message on the socials. You can let me know who you'd like to see me chat to. And just let us know what you think of the pod. I'm back next time. Be excellent to each other. Stay safe. And I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.